Please be seated. If I were a big city preacher, I would wear seersucker on Easter Sunday morning. But we don't have to do that here because we have the Tetons and we have snowstorms on Easter Sunday morning. If I were a big city preacher, I would wear seersucker on Easter Sunday morning because Easter Sunday is the brightest of bright lights. Of the 365 days in our calendar as Christian people, it's the top of the pyramid, and it should shine brightly in the experience and in the embodiment of our faith. And there's something about seersucker that gives us just a little extra, right? I intend to preach a sermon, an Easter Sunday sermon this year that might be a little different than the ones I've preached in the past or the ones that you've heard other preachers preach. I want to preach a sermon so that the Easter story might take hold of us and we might live it. I have some sense that it's probably true that every single one of us in this church this morning knows the Easter story. If we didn't know it before we came in, then we just heard Travis read one of the versions of that story. I could even go so far as to say, I would expect that not only do we know that story, but many of us in this church this morning believe the story. We have some sense of what the story says may have happened in the way that it was told for most part, even though each of the four accounts are somewhat different. I want to preach an Easter Sunday sermon so that you might not just know, or you might not just believe, but you might live the Easter story. And in order to do that, I need to lean toward the metaphors of the story, connecting the story from the very beginning to the very end. And I'm going to do my best to do that without creating too much confusion. So buckle your seatbelts and hold on. And if I lose you in advance, I'm sorry. What I should say about Easter first is it's not crystal clear. The story itself is somewhat confusing. When we listen to one version over and against the other, the stories are quite different. We listen to John's account of the Easter story. If we were to listen to Mark's account of the Easter story, it's very stark and it's somewhat arresting. It simply says that the women went to the tomb to prepare Jesus' body. They found the stone rolled away from the entrance of the tomb. They looked inside and the body of Jesus was gone, and they ran away afraid. And then about three decades later, John writes the account that we have today with tons more details, many more characters in the story, and there are some comedic hits that we miss because we read the story as we read it, in fancy clothes, in a relative monotone voice, in the church, but we're going to get to those details. I would say about these gospel Easter accounts, if we were to look at them through the lens of American literature, then Mark is Hemingway and John is Faulkner. And we are dealing with Faulkner this morning, so let's get after it. The story opens in the same way that Mark's story opens, with Mary Magdalene going to the tomb and finding that it's empty. Rather than running away sore afraid and just a period ending at the sentence, Mary Magdalene goes to find Peter, and then the story reads, the other disciple. Now, we're supposed to know that the other disciple is, in fact, John, the one who is writing the story that we are listening to or reading. John calls himself two different things other than John. He calls himself the other disciple. He also calls himself the one that Jesus loved. Isn't that wonderful? He writes that about himself. Peter and the one that Jesus loved learn that the tomb is empty. The story reads, the details of the story, if you remember listening to it, say, they begin a foot race. Peter and John begin running to the tomb, and then John points out this detail of like, well, I got there first. Well done, John. Blue ribbon. Then Peter arrives. But as Peter is arriving, there's this wonderful detail, and that's where I want to start this idea of us living Easter. There's this beautiful detail in the story where it says John arrives at the tomb, and he looks in, and he sees that it's empty, but he does not go in. And as I was reading that last week, I began to read it through the sensibilities of a pastor and the sensibilities of a spiritual quester. And I went back and I read it, and it says, John, he didn't go in the tomb. And my reaction was just like, oh, buddy. Oh, bro, you have to go in the tomb. In order for the Easter story to shine as brightly as it does, you have to go in the tomb. Now, I'm going to back up a little bit and talk a bit about how the tradition tells this particular story. It's a three-day story, right? It's a triptych. It's a triduum, as the church calls it. And there are these three specific beats of the story. The first beat is the Thursday to Friday beat. The second is the Friday to Saturday beat, of which there's very little written. And the third is the Saturday to Sunday beat, which we hear and celebrate this morning and for the next 50 days, if not all of our lives. The Thursday beat begins in this idyllic way, and maybe we don't quite hear it that way because we just get immersed in the story itself, or it's so familiar that these metaphors don't land for us. But the Thursday story begins around what? Around a table. It's a beautiful story with friends gathered around a table. More than friends. Friends, co-workers, spiritual questers who have deep and abiding relationship with one another. There is real intimacy shared across and around this table. We know how it goes. We've been at those tables ourselves. Thaddeus, could you pass the unleavened bread? Peter, Jesus needs more wine. Is there salt on the table? Philip, bring us the olive oil. What we also know from scholars is that even though this is the Passover meal, they wouldn't be standing up. They would be reclining in such a way as their bodies were touching one another. This was the tightest of groups. They're not just having a dinner party, though. This dinner party has two rich symbols connected to it. The first, of course, is the Passover meal. Here, these Jews, 2,000 or more years later, celebrating God's saving act, the most important episode in Israel's history is being ritualized around this table. Not only would these disciples and Jesus himself remember this reality, but it would also touch in them those nostalgic experiences that they've had all through their lives. You see, each one of these disciples and Jesus would have been at this particular kind of table every year, once a year, in a powerful, nostalgic way, looking backwards into God's salvific act for Israel, and in the very present moment, sharing and celebrating the love that existed across their familial tables and across time itself. That's the first metaphor. There's a second metaphor that we miss that is even more important. You see, these people, and we, these people are made for the table. The table doesn't just look back to the Passover. The table looks back to the very first and second story that we have from Genesis. There's the Exodus reference at Passover, but we are remembering the very beginning, the first story where God storms into the cosmos out of chaos and begins to create. And the first thing that God begins to do is sow goodness. That Genesis 1, God is sowing goodness all throughout creation and into every creature and every aspect of creation. And then the second story, which is where our table story lands today, is this beautiful model of connectedness. The story of Genesis 2 is a story of interdependence, about how we were built, we were made for relationship, we were created for collaboration. All of creation, in this beautiful image that we have from the garden, is an image of interdependence. Man and woman and God, each afternoon, strolling through the garden at the cool of the evening. That's the image that we're meant to see around the Maundy Thursday table. Creation embodying itself in its most ideal way, where each creature and each aspect of creation is connected one to another. That's the beginning of our Thursday story. Of course, as Thursday moves to Friday, the story begins to fall apart, right? This beautiful scene of intimacy and trust and connectedness is demolished in the most symbolic of ways. Judas betrays Jesus, and not just Jesus, but creation and the model of creation. Judas betrays Jesus and rejects God's design of creation through a kiss. An act of intimacy and love is an act of betrayal and brokenness and mistrust. As Thursday moves to Friday, things fall apart. Things fall apart as they do. right? Anxiety and confusion give way to fear, and fear gives way to violence. First, someone loses an ear, and then God himself is murdered on a cross. We move in this dramatic way from one beat to the next, from intimacy to betrayal. Judas is the embodiment of independence, of pride. I think I know a better way. I versus the we. Now, as we move from Friday to Saturday, the story becomes a bit less clear. But we might reach into our own experience and give some consideration about the realities of our own lives as we begin to talk a bit about this move that we have from Friday to Saturday. We enter the tomb Friday to Saturday. It is a dark experience. It's a confusing experience. It's one where everything is obscured and there is no clarity. Perhaps you have found yourself in your own life in one of these places before. For more than 10 years, as I've been meditating upon these three beats of the story, and this is not in the narrative anywhere, but I imagine that Jesus awakens from the tomb, not on Sunday morning when an angel pushes a stone away and light interrupts the darkness of the tomb, but that Jesus wakes up like we do, like right in the middle of it, like Saturday morning, 8 o'clock. What's this stuff on my head? What's this pain in my side? My hands, my feet, my heart are broken. It is the rocky bottom. It's the rocky bottom that in order for us to understand the brightest of brightness of Easter, we must go there. Sorry, John. You got to go into the tomb. You got to find yourself on the bottom that is rock. You must draw your sword and slay the dragon. We caterpillars must create the chrysalis in order to become the butterfly. The beats from Friday to Saturday are darkness, obscurity, a sense of lostness, of disconnection, the absence of hope. But as we move from Saturday to Sunday, there is a change. Now, to be clear, the change doesn't happen automatically, and the change doesn't usher in an era of everything is always going to be okay. That's not the message of Easter. If you remember from Mark's account all the way through John's account, the action of Easter emerges slowly. This place where we are meant to find ourselves. This story that we're meant to know and then to believe and then to live, it doesn't happen automatically. It doesn't happen automatically in the book, and it doesn't happen automatically in our lives too. The promise of Easter is not that everything from here on out is perfection, it's gravy, it's easy. The promise of Easter is that which is broken and that which felt broken forever, that That moment where we found ourselves on the very bottom, obscured in utter darkness, that moment where we find ourselves in the deepest, darkest part of the tomb begins to be revealed, restored in a powerful way. We find ourselves coming out of the tomb confused but connected. And the relationships that are restored, this one with God, this relationship that we have with God is restored forever. And the relationships that we share across our lives, across these pews, across a table, throughout the history of our lives, those are restored too. The act of Easter is the restoration of humanity with God and humanity one with another. And so we find ourselves asking ourselves, then what do we do with that? What do we do with this restoration, this reconnection of relationship both with God, with one another? We have to go back to Thursday, right? We have to remember that the action of interdependence, the action of creation is love. The rabbi gets down and ties an apron around his waist and he washes the feet of his friends. My brothers and sisters and siblings in Christ, the promise of Easter is reconnection. The action of Easter, our action, our call is love. Amen.